Welcome to Kibbe on Liberty. Matt, how's it going?
Great. How are you, Matt?
I'm doing well. I'm glad we finally got to schedule this. You are the primary author of a series of monographs under the banner of The Realities of Socialism. And I know that you've co-authored several with my friend and Austrian economist, Peter Betke. And I love this project. I've now gotten through several of them, because you guys have successfully integrated economics, history, culture, and also there's politics in there, because you talk about the politics of transition from socialism to market economies, which is a thing I want to talk about. But the thing that struck me most was the shocking polling. So I'm on realitiesofsocialism.org. And I've seen these polls before, but you guys have done a bunch of polling showing that I think it's 43% of Americans from 18 to 25 think that socialism is a better system than capitalism. How did that happen?
Yeah, I mean, it is remarkable. When I started this project, one of the things that was sort of rolling around my head is this timeline and my personal timeline. And at some point I realized that, you know, right now we are as far away from the fall of the Berlin Wall as I was from Hitler's death when I was born. And, you know, it struck me that the previous generation had, you know, done their darndest to make sure that people that were born when I was born were under no illusions about what fascism was like, Hitlerism was like, National Socialism was like. We were, raised on that awareness. And I worry that people raised today are just not raised in that same level of awareness about what the other horror of the 20th century, socialism, was actually like.
Yeah, it's these are things that, but I'm older than you, I suspect. I'm fairly certain that's true. We were certainly taught, you know, this old political spectrum, and I would call it a myth of, you know, the hard left was Stalin and Lenin and Mao and Pol Pot, and the hard right was Hitler and Mussolini and other fascists, and it never made sense, but we were mostly taught about the horrible, inhumane genocides on this far right spectrum. I didn't learn about Stalinist murderous record in high school. I did in college, because I went to Grove City College, but that's a unicorn. Most kids today are not going to Grove City College,
right?
So it's always been a problem, and I think it's probably the romance in academia that, you know, for all of the murderous track records of socialism in practice, you know, they just didn't get it right, and that's not really socialism, and their intentions were far better than market advocates, and I think that mythology has always been part of certainly American academia.
Yeah, that's right. So there's a couple things here that, you know, we try to kind of highlight in this is you know, an important part of the story here, of course, is the open collaboration between Hitler and Stalin. And, you know, many people, maybe if they haven't heard about that, are surprised to learn that the two collaborated, and were allies. But if you dig into what they said and what they thought, if you go to the Holocaust website and you peruse the platforms of the Nazi Party, you see, you know, this is, the National Socialist Party. You see that there's a half dozen planks on that platform that live up to the socialist half of its name. You know, Hitler, just like Stalin, was interested in socializing major sectors of the economy, and was interested in socializing economic decisions from interest rates to how, you know, department stores were. So there's a lot more, you know, in Congress than I think either Hitler or Stalin really wanted to emphasize. And then the other thing is that, you know, the coercion is baked in to the socialist approach to the economy. If you want to control who buys and who sells, and you know, as Marx and Engels put it, you know, the socialist idea can be summed up in one sentence: abolition of private property. You want to abolish private property, you're essentially controlling people's lives, and you're setting yourself up for conflict, which is one of the reasons, of course, why socialist thinkers themselves always emphasize the struggle that's built into you know, what they're trying to achieve. Is it's a class warfare. It is one class pitted against another. It's people who, you're going to encounter people who want to continue to control their own property, their own houses, their own farms, and you're going to have to struggle with them, which is why, you know, I don't think it's an accident of history that, you know, the socialist states over and over and over again were highly repressive states that not only controlled what people bought and sold, but also what they thought and what they wrote and what they painted.
Yeah, it's, I mean, if you read Marx and Engels, who were decidedly the biggest advocates of cultural violence in the socialist intellectual tree, but it was also probably inevitable because you are forcing people to do things they wouldn't otherwise do. And when they say no, the government steps in and forces you to, and sometimes catastrophic ways. The other thing that's fascinating, when you listen to an actual Marxist talk about policy, they're collectivist methodologically too, because they don't really think about people. They don't think about individuals. It's all a numbers game, and it's an aggregate. So if in fact they break a few eggs, as supposedly Lenin said, I don't know if he actually said it, it doesn't really matter in their world, because they're thinking about the collective. They don't care that they've slaughtered a lot of people along that path to utopia.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And you can see this in decision after decision that they made. You know, maybe the first signs of it were during Lenin's time, when he set up the Europe's first concentration camps, and he set up the first secret police. But then you see it in Stalin's, you know, systematic murder of enemies. You saw it in his just absolutely depraved pursuit of collectivization in agriculture, which led to the deaths of, you know, somewhere between 5 and 7 million of his own citizens, simply because he was so stubbornly attached to the idea that socialism could outproduce capitalism. And, you know, he was totally uncowed, was not convinced, and continued to pursue the policy of collectivization, you know, well after this disaster. And of course, so did others, including Mao, with his Great Leap Forward.
So you, as an educator, and certainly everything that we try to do at Free the People, we struggle with this data point that we understand the realities of socialism in practice, and we understand the economic impossibility of central planning the way that Marx originally envisioned. But it doesn't seem to connect with people. And the thing I like about your project is there's plenty of economics in there, and there's hardcore Austrian analysis of the failures of socialism and you know, what happens when you don't have prices. But that's not really the basis. And I'll talk about Estonia, but the other monographs as well. You're focused on the entire story, and you personalize the story as much as you can, so that people that are willing to dig a little bit deeper can live this experience. And you focus also on history and culture and how people in the trapped in these systems actually were able to get out of them through nonviolent action, typically, but obviously other types as well. I assume that was conscious. Like, this project comes out of perhaps a sense of frustration that we're not connecting with people with what we're doing now.
Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, one of the motivations here is I'm the head of the Center for Economic Freedom at Fraser, and we produce this annual report on economic freedom, which has been wildly successful. The lead author, unfortunately, just passed away, Jim Gwardney, was really a giant in the economics profession, but it's now in the capable hands of his student, Bob Lawson, who's doing an awesome job. But this report, you know, it's all numbers, it's data, and it's I find it extremely compelling. You know, there's been over 1,500 peer-reviewed academic studies that use this data in regressions to predict outcomes that people care about. And we find that, you know, in freer societies, people not only have higher per capita income, but they live longer, they have lower infant mortality rates, they have less corruption, higher self-reported happiness, all kinds of, you know, things that people care about. But it does kind of, you know, humans, a lot of that data just sort of, there's an interesting characteristic of us, you know, it just kind of goes over your head. But if you stop and you tell a story, sometimes that sticks. So that's exactly what we were trying to do here in telling, you know, some of the stories here in Estonia, because they're harrowing and they're heartbreaking sometimes, but they're also, in many cases, beautiful stories. So, you know, for example, one story is about this family who their father was a husband and wife, and they had two young children. The father was a ship captain. His ship was nationalized by the Soviets, and they never saw him again. And then their house, like so many Estonians, their house was invaded by individuals. So, you know, it's when we think about, like, you know, a whole country, you know, invading another country, you think about it in the aggregate. But what this means is, you know, a Red Army soldier knocks on the door and says, "We're going to be stationed here." And so this Red Army soldier occupied their property for about a year. Then the Germans broke their pact with the Soviets and, you know, invaded Moscow. And lo and behold, now the Red Army soldier is gone and you've got a Nazi soldier staying in their house. And what does that mean? Well, you know, practically to have a Nazi soldier, you know, staying in your house, well, it means when the soldier takes an unhealthy interest in the young girl who lives there, poor young, you know, the mother sends the young girl down the street to go stay at a friend's house because the Nazi soldier is constantly and inappropriately asking her to go hunting with him in the woods. You know, that's what we're talking about. When we're talking about, you know, oppression, it's at the household level, it's at the individual level. And it's also, you know, kind of going back to this point that we were talking about earlier, the sort of continuity between Nazi National Socialism and socialism is, you know, from their perspective, they were both awful. You know, both occupations were terrible. The Estonians were, you know, for a time quite happy to have the Soviets move in because their historical enemies had been the Germans. And in just 9 months of, you know, Soviet occupation, they were pretty happy to have the Germans come in. And then after 2 years of the German occupation, they were disabused of any notion that this was going to be better. And it was just, you know, they talked about it as being between two wolves. You know, it doesn't matter what uniform they're wearing. It's still oppression.
Free the People is embarking on our most ambitious project to date to document and expose the lies behind the greatest public health failure in my lifetime. We're talking to insiders with firsthand knowledge of the government's role in funding, creating, and then covering up the COVID-19 virus in our exclusive new documentary series, The Cover-Up. But I need your help. We won't get to the bottom of this scandal alone, so I'm asking viewers to crowdsource any information that could be helpful to our investigation. If you're watching this, you already know what the government did during lockdowns was unforgivable. Help us get to the truth and prevent it from ever happening again. To get involved, go to freethepeople.org/coverup. That's freethepeople.org/coverup. The truth is out there.
You know, one of the things that you write about in the book is the strong
sense of cultural, I won't use say national, but cultural identity that Estonians had that made them more difficult to oppress than other Soviet satellites, and perhaps ultimately led to the ability of the Estonians to break free from Soviet control. Talk about that.
Yeah. So that's a fascinating part about it. So one of the ways I like to describe it is the Estonians are this ancient people in a young country. So ethnic Estonians had been trawling the waters off of Estonia and planting the relatively pretty poor soil in Estonia for 5,000 years. So they've been there a long, long time, but it wasn't until the 19th century that they had started to sort of think of themselves as a country, as a nation and sort of a coherent ethnic group. But they do have their own language. They do have their own traditions. One of these traditions is singing. And so for as far as anybody can remember, Estonians have been, gathering together around campfires, usually in these big festivals in the summer. And they've been doing these song festivals in singing in sort of call and response fashion, where they sing, the tradition, the stories of their people, of the origin of the earth. And so that sort of tradition actually never died. And I think part of the reason it didn't die is because of this sort of late awakening in their they call it the national awakening in the 19th century, where really cultural entrepreneurs rolled up their sleeves and started institutions, schools, institutions that promote the arts, regular song festival groups, where they basically just tried to, make it a habit to, think about and recognize the Estonian culture. And that really sustained the Estonians in a lot of ways. So the interesting thing happened with the song festival. So it goes back to the 19th century. They would have the huge song festival, and the Russians, when they came in, and I do emphasize the Russians, it's not just the Soviet Union. It was really the Russians who saw themselves as the first among equals within the Soviet Union. They couldn't suppress the actual festival. They let it keep happening, but they changed it. So instead of singing love songs to the Estonian, culture and in the Estonian tongue, they were made to sing love songs to Stalin and Lenin, right, in the Russian tongue. And what ended up happening is the Estonians very carefully just tested how far the state would let them go. So they would, do their part and sing along to the Soviet songs, because of course there were Red Army soldiers there that were armed and sort of making them. But then when they had a chance, they would break down they would break from the scripts, and they'd sing spontaneously. They'd sing their traditional Estonian songs. And when you've got 30,000 people singing a song, and it's maybe being filmed, it's maybe being broadcast, even as powerful a state as the Soviet Union couldn't stop that. They would try to drown them out. They'd get the army band to try to drown them out, but they really couldn't stop it. And so that sort of, kind of trying to push the envelope was really an important characteristic, I think, of the Estonians that sort of helped sustain them for a lot of that occupation.
There's this book I've been obsessed about for decades now called A Force More Powerful, which is a bunch of case studies about nonviolent resistance to various flavors of authoritarian government. And I'm thinking of the similar but different response to Lech Walesa and the Solidarity Movement. And I assume this is, I haven't read the story about Poland yet, but I assume that's part of it. At some point, like obviously they would have loved to just kill all of the protesters, but it had galvanized the public imagination, and it creates a dilemma for them. And ultimately, if there's 30,000 people singing Estonian folk songs, you got a problem on your hands, and just slaughtering them probably isn't an option.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so, one of the things that's interesting, especially in light of, going back to the polling that you talked about at the beginning, if you think about what is it that makes people so young people so passionate about the prospects of this socialist utopia? I think, you know, you talk to a lot of them, and there's two things that are often, you know, big motivations. One is the plight of the working man and woman, labor, and the other is the environment. And the interesting thing is, in Poland, the revolt against socialism was led by workers. It was a worker revolt. And in Estonia, it began as an environmental protest against, you know, yet one more Soviet proposal to rape the Estonian land. So in Poland, really, it started with this woman who, she was considered a Stakhanovite worker, which means she had been honored by the Soviet state for her hard work ethic. And so she was essentially this model worker in a shipyard. But she had this, you know, strong conscience, and she had this sort of sense of social justice. And she had seen a communist leader take money. I think it was her supervisor take money and use it, you know, for his personal enrichment, which was unfortunately relatively common in throughout socialist states. And so she did what she thought she should do, and she reported it. And instead of being rewarded, she was fired. And you know, this set off a wave of protests among her colleagues, who just thought this was absolutely ridiculous. And so she and Lech Walesa ended up, you know, forming the Solidarity Trade Movement. And, you know, they're helped a lot, of course, by the new Catholic Pope, who was selected from Poland, who comes and visits the country. Again, the Soviets can't really stop that from happening. And he tells the Polish people, be not afraid, you know, have solidarity. And so they form this Solidarity Union, in part sort of as a response to that. And they, you know, protest, and they within a year, one third of the entire the entire Polish population were members of this trade union. It was the largest non-state trade union throughout the entire socialist world. The Soviets do crack down on this. This is the long December night of December 14th, 1981. They do crack down on it. They arrest thousands of people. You know, one man was a operator of a train, and he had blown a whistle, I think, for 20 seconds in support of Solidarity. And for that 20-second blowing of the whistle, he got something like 5 years in prison. But when they went to go get Lech Walesa, he said, this is the last nail in the coffin of communism. You've lost. It took the rest of the 1980s to actually realize that he was right. It might have seemed at the time that, no, the Soviet state was as strong as ever. But, you know, that sort of overreaction, especially in an environment when Gorbachev is talking about glasnost, openness, and perestroika, change, reform, you know, it sort of just showed the how deceptive the system was, and that it wasn't living up to its promise.
It, you know, the juxtaposition, if you're trying to capture the public narrative, and I would go all the way back to John Adams, who supposedly said at the time of the American Revolution, it was one third Tory, one third revolutionaries, and one third they didn't give a damn. And I'm paraphrasing. But I suspect that that's almost always true when you're trying to galvanize the public imagination. And to me, this isn't probably always true, but it strikes me that the most compelling transitions from the violence of socialism to a market-based economy is going to be about nonviolence, cooperation. It's going to be values-based, and it's going to be something that the people that are in the middle, and, you know, perhaps being strategically quiet because they don't want to get targeted by the authoritarians, they become galvanized because of that more beautiful narrative.
Yeah, I think that's right. And so one of the ways you can see this is some of the incidents that happened during the Singing Revolution, which is when Estonia broke free from the Soviet Union. So one of these incidents, so there had been, I mentioned earlier that the Soviet Union is 15 different republics, but the first among equals by far was the Russians. the Russian Republic. They saw themselves as, you know, they were the first. They knew how socialism worked, and they were going to impose it and improve the lives of every other Soviet republic. The Estonian joke, by the way, was, you know, how many five-year plans does it take before the level of prosperity in Estonia is reduced to that of the Soviet Union? Because the Estonians were always a little bit richer than the rest of the Soviet Union. So anyway, but one of the strategies there that is that the was Russification. So they, you know, tried to crush the Estonian language. They tried to move Russians into the Estonian Soviet Republic, gave them the better jobs, and so this kind of when we're the Estonians were trying to agitate for their own freedoms, you know, in the late 1980s, you still had a sizable portion of Russians that were living in Estonia that were, you know, pretty unhappy about any kind of change, right? They benefited from the current system. So this sets up this potential for, you know, a lot of bloodshed. And one of the incidents that happened is the loyalists to the Soviet Union, mostly ethnic Russians, surrounded the Estonian parliament. And they, you know, were essentially opposed to measures that the Estonian parliament was taking, like adopting trying to adopt the Estonian flag, trying to send petitions to the central government saying we would like some more autonomy. And so what happened is you've got thousands of, you know, Russian communists surrounding the Estonian parliament. And the Estonians got on the radio and they said, Estonian people, come help us. And so the Russians actually had broken into this ancient seat of parliament. It's an old castle. The scenes are not all that dissimilar from January 6th, that's interestingly enough. So they'd broken into the government, and now you have them being surrounded by the Estonian people. The Estonian people heard the call, and they showed up, and they outnumbered them significantly. So now what are we going to do? You've got all these insurrectionists, essentially, the communists and the Russians inside the parliament, and they're surrounded by thousands of Estonians. What's going to happen? Is this going to lead to bloodshed? Amazingly, it doesn't. The Estonians part ways and they allow the Russians to exit, and there's not a single drop of blood spilled. So they were very self-conscious about trying to make this as peaceful as possible. And, you know, over and over, there were potentially violent incidents that ended up being resolved without bloodshed. It's really pretty spectacular.
And just strategically smart, because you're confronting someone so much more militarily powerful than you are.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. And, you know, maybe there's no, I'll give you two other examples of this, no more beautiful examples of this than the actual, you know, singing revolution. So this was a, began with a spontaneous demonstration in June at the Song Festival. Ultimately, hundreds of thousands of people showed up. There was a later demonstration that was more organized, in which 300,000 people showed up at the Song Festival grounds. Now, think about this: a country of 1 million people. So, one in three Estonians are there, and they're singing. That's all they're doing, is they're singing traditional Estonian songs. They're also singing some songs that demonstrate, you know, their pretty bitter feelings about the Soviet system and the socialist system, but they're doing it all peacefully. And then the other thing that they did is they organized what's called the Baltic Way or the Baltic Chain. And so this was in coordination with people from Latvia and Lithuania. They formed this 670-kilometer human chain stretching across three countries involving 2 million people. And all they do is they're holding hands. And the important thing is that they're holding hands on August 23rd. Which is the anniversary of the infamous Nazi-Soviet Pact, in which leaders of the two countries essentially agreed to carve up the Europe, with the Soviets getting the eastern half and the Nazis getting the western half. So very strategic, very smart, and peaceful. It's really pretty amazing that this happened.
At Kibbe on Liberty, freedom is a lifestyle 24/7, something you live and breathe and wear every day. If that describes you, you need the very best Liberty swag in the market today. just like this shirt I happen to be wearing. Go to freethepeople.org/KOL and check out our exciting merch. You too can love liberty and look cool. Yeah, again, juxtaposition, the peaceful cooperation, you know, like there's a metaphor here for what we want versus the violent oppression of this the Soviet regime. I want to talk, let's follow that, because the music part of it, and let's call it pop culture, even though it's steeped in Estonian history. This part is fascinating to me because you know, in your book you point out that there's a progressive rock musician who sort of jumps on the puts his surfboard on the wave here and starts writing modern protest songs. And you have Mart Lahr, who I want to get into as well, who's very much into some of my favorite bands, Led Zeppelin and Queen and things like that. So it invokes the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia, which was very much triggered by the oppression and ultimate jailing of a progressive underground band called Plastic People of the Universe, and Vaclav Havel was animated by their jailing, and that led to that revolution. This is quite similar because you have the same dynamics where free artistic expression is a vivid reminder of what they aren't allowed to do in Estonia.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, some of the story does start with, you know, Gorbachev and what he allowed and what he didn't allow. So remember, you know, Gorbachev comes to power and he's the first, you know, post-revolution Soviet leader. And so as a result of that, I do think he kind of understood, and he's quoted as saying this quite a few times, that he knew something had to change. And so his two proposals are perestroika and glasnost. And perestroika means reform. As it turns out, he was just absolutely unwilling to actually entertain serious reforms. He was not interested in entertaining, you know, a break from socialism. And he, you know, at one point he summons Estonian leaders to Moscow, and he says, it's on video, you can see him saying, you know, understand, don't make too much of a fuss. Those are literally his words. And he says, any solutions you find have to be within the socialist system. So he was really not open to much reform. But his other aspect of change he called glasnost, which was openness. And in the world of international CNN, right, and, you know, international news networks and TV cameras, this party actually did sort of follow through on. And so this is in part, I think, where this nonviolent civil protest ends up being important. So it's in that environment in which you get this very curious, interesting mix of, again, think back, an ancient people in a new country, a young country. They're singing sometimes, you know, 3,000-year-old songs, and then they're singing brand new songs. And then if you look at the videos, you know, it's got these you know, beautiful, you know, young kids with pigtails in this traditional Estonian dress singing these songs. And you think, oh, they must be singing, you know, beautiful love songs. And some of them are love songs to Estonia, but some of them have a bitter, you know, some of the newer ones especially have this sort of bitter taste to them. So here's one of them. If you descend in lies, upside down in dreams, onto all fours under the command, onto the belly under the ruble, then you get fleas to the groin, mange in the heart, tapeworms in the head, bones in the belly, then you go to hell. So, you know, you've got these beautiful, happy people singing some pretty angry songs. And that was kind of what was the environment at the time. Very, very interesting. And then a lot of it is led by young people. So you mentioned Mart Lahr and, you know, he's a Guns N' Roses and Queen and Phil Collins fan. He was only 32 when he becomes the first democratically elected leader in Estonia. And he's got several other members of his parliament that are all in their 20s and 30s. So it was a very youthful sort of revolt.
Yeah, kind of a punk rock aesthetic, mm-hmm. which at its best is anti-authoritarian. Right. we won't talk about Rage Against the Machine because yeah. I can't explain that one. But so I want to talk about history because this gets into Mart Lahr's version of the story because he is essential in the transformation of Estonia into a prosperous nation. But he gets involved in, and I guess you'll correct me because he's holding these public conversations about Estonian history, and he's a history professor. Is it college or high school? I don't know what his deal is at the time.
So he doesn't get his PhD until after he's actually prime minister. So I think he may have only been a high school history teacher at the time, but I could be wrong on that. It's possible he was teaching at the college level without.
But it's profound that a let's say a high school history professor teacher is basically leading a revolution, leading by not leading, as I love to say. But this idea, you know, we started this conversation pointing out that too many young people, not just in America, you pull other countries as well, they don't know the history of these ideas that have absolutely been tried and absolutely been catastrophic failures in the context of human dignity. And this was a key part of Estonia's movement towards freedom is just reminding people of their own history. And a key part of the Soviet model was to erase history.
Yeah, that's right.
There's a
that's
metaphor right. in here somewhere too.
Yeah, that's right. So again, go back to this date, this August 23rd. So let me just paint the picture for you. It's August 23rd, 1939. Herr von Ribbentrop, who's the Nazi foreign minister, he lands in Moscow. He's greeted by six giant swastika flags that are flying proudly for him. These flags had only weeks earlier been used in Nazi propaganda, or sorry, Soviet propaganda against Nazis. Now the Soviets take them out of the propaganda studio and proudly wave them. He's whisked off to the Kremlin, where he gets to meet with Stalin himself. They sign the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. Molotov, by the way, is the Soviet foreign minister. He'd only been on the job for about 9 months. And the reason is that his predecessor was Jewish, and Stalin had fired him as a conciliatory gesture to Hitler. Ironically, Molotov's wife was Jewish. She ultimately, you know, Stalin himself was quite anti-Semitic. And Stalin ended up arresting Molotov's wife, and ultimately Molotov lost his job because of his wife's Jewish ancestry. In any case, they formed this pact. Publicly, the main point of the pact is non-aggression, but there are secret protocols to the pact, secret protocols that are, one, the worst-kept secrets of the Cold War, because people in the Baltic states knew about them within weeks. And two, they are denied. Their very existence is denied for a half century, well into the Gorbachev era. Gorbachev was denying them and saying, you know, this is not, this is just propaganda from the West. There's no such thing as protocols. The Estonian people joined the Soviet Union of their own free will, which was just not true. And so these protocols called for the invasion of carving, as I mentioned earlier, carving up Europe. And, you know, at the end, Stalin, who was kind of a teetotaler, actually toasts to Hitler's health. And so one of the things that the early protesters in Estonia, now let's jump forward four decades. Actually, before I jump forward, let me just quickly say how they ended up being, you know, subsumed to the Soviet Union is the Soviets invade Poland from the east and the Germans from the west. They take it over with. By the end of September 1939, it's jointly occupied. They have this joint Nazi-Soviet parade in Brest-Litovsk. And then the Soviets move 160,000 troops to the border of Estonia. On the other side, there's only 16,000 Estonian troops. They demand that Estonia sign a non-aggression pact with them. Estonians feel it, and they have no choice, so they do so. And then within months, they say that their Baltic friends in Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania are plotting against them. And so they demand to hold elections. They're fraudulent elections. There's one instance where the turnout was 122%. There's another where the results of the election were announced accidentally before the election had even taken place. And then with Red Army soldiers in parliament, that these are armed soldiers, the newly elected parliament in Estonia petitions the Soviet Union for entrance. So, you know, they ask to be let into the Soviet Union. So that's the circumstances of how they got in there. And what's important now jump forward, you know, five decades later, we're talking in the late 80s. And the Estonians hit on this strategy of emphasizing the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, not just as a way to sort of embarrass the Soviets, which I think probably it was an embarrassment, certainly, but also to highlight that the way that the Estonia had been dragooned into the Soviet Union was entirely illegal. And if it was illegally annexed, then they argued Estonia isn't even a part of the Soviet Union. They had been living through five decades of a lie. And so by emphasizing that, that was an important legal strategy and ultimately helped them gain their independence. But it does mean that they sort of, to use Orwell's line from 1984, he who controls the past controls the present, and he who controls the present controls the future. Well, the Estonians managed to take control of their past by just speaking the truth about how they had been forced into the Soviet Union. And by taking control of that, they managed to write their destiny and have a future for themselves independent of the Soviet Union.
Thank you for joining me today on Kibbe on Liberty and for being part of our fiercely independent audience. Every week, my organization, Free the People, partners with Blaze TV to bring you this show. My guests bring smart perspectives on everything from current events to timeless philosophical debates. If you like what you hear, go to freethepeople.org/KOL and support Kibbe on Liberty so we can continue to produce these honest conversations with interesting people. Now, let's get back to it. And this is when Mart Lahr becomes a sort of leader in the revolution, just reminding people of this history. How does he become such a popular figure that he is not immediately, but soon after the fall of the Soviet control, becomes the first prime minister at 32 or something young like that?
So, you know, and one thing I want to emphasize is, you know, there's a lot of different factions here. There's more radical factions and then there's more moderate. He was probably a little bit more radical, but there were people that were more radical than he was. Essentially he's out there. He forms the Estonian Heritage Society their whole mission is to talk openly about the past, especially the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. But the other past, the 19 years that Estonia had spent as an independent country, for example. So he, sort of like the American Revolution, you know, you've got different factions with, you know, you think about Adams and Hamilton and Jefferson and Washington. All these folks sort of disagreed and could be put on a different spectrums and ultimately came together and, you know, the architects of the American Revolution ended up being the first politicians to hold office, and that was the case with Lahr, as well as many of the other leaders, during that time. And when he came to office, he's essentially, I think you've met him, I have not. He's an unassuming man, right? He's kind of got this sort of quirky way about him. And one of the things he says, I think he's repeated the story many times, is that, you know, as a kid, he didn't know anything about economics, but he had heard about this just evil Western economist, Milton Friedman, that the Soviets said was just this, evil person. And he thought, well, gee, if this is what the Soviets think is a bad economist, I better read him because he might be good. And so he picked up Freedom and Prosperity and Free to Choose, and he read them. And in his telling, he just sort of thought this was normal economics. He just assumed, well, all of this stuff had been done in the United States, right? They'd already implemented this stuff, so let's just do it. He kind of didn't appreciate, in my view, how radical he was being, And what he ended up, you know, proposing and presiding over is the world's first flat personal income tax rate. It also applies to corporate income. It's actually only a distributed profits tax. So not a dollar is taxed until it's actually distributed to owners or shareholders. He proposed and managed to get balanced budgets. Estonia is unique among all the former socialist countries as consistently balancing its budgets. They got a pretty radical form of monetary reform. This actually preceded him, but he supported it, where they tied their currency to the a new currency to the Deutsche Mark, and it was enforced through a currency board. They unilaterally, emphasize this, unilaterally eliminated all tariffs and all barriers to foreign trade. This was, you know, an important, essentially down payment on further reform, because if you are allowing your companies to now be in competition with any other company worldwide, you better make sure that other governance systems are running well, that you've got a good rule of law, property is well protected, you've got decent regulatory systems, you're not oppressing companies through regulations or taxes. So it was a very important down payment. Privatization, you know, they as best as they could, their first approach to privatization was, look, if you can find any proof that you owned this property before the Soviets came in and nationalized it, congratulations, it's yours. So, you know, we tell the story of a widow who went into her backyard and dug up a tin and opened it up and found a piece of paper that she had buried there 5 decades earlier with her husband, showing that she and her husband had owned this block of stores. She took it down to the local authorities and said, look, this is the proof that I used to own this. And the authorities said, yep, it sure is. Congratulations, you own it again. So that's sort of almost, it's simple. It's really, you know, it's not all that complicated, but it was bold in the sense that he was just willing to he knew what needed to be done. A lot of people did at the time, but he insisted that it just be done quickly. Don't stand there quivering. He adopted the phrase, just do it. You know, the appropriately capitalistic phrase, just do it, because he knew it was going to be difficult and it was the right thing to do. And it wasn't going to be made any easier by soft pedaling it and dragging it out.
Yeah, I got to hang out with him, and your description is accurate. He's chill, he's friendly, he's unassuming, and this is after he has succeeded in this dramatic transformation that is sustainable to this day, and he jokes about it, but I suspect the joke is real. Like when he was reading Friedman, he just thought that was sort of normal Western American policy, and that we had done all these things, and at some point after he did it, he discovered that we hadn't done any of that stuff. We didn't do school choice. We hadn't stabilized our currency. We hadn't balanced our budget, and we weren't so great at privatization either. By the way, it's noticeable. We're watching, and I want to get into transition, because I think this is again a very important strategic question. Like we understand economically what works, but that doesn't tell us how we get from where we are to where we need to be in a lot of countries. I'll include my own in this, but I'm of course thinking of Argentina, which has been a quasi-socialist basket case with hyperinflation for most of my adult life. And we have another guy who's, one of his dogs is named Milton, after Milton Friedman. And I'm guessing he's read exactly the same books that Mart Lahr read, and you could look at the policies that Javier Milei has rolled out as the new, I don't know if he's a president or prime minister, I should know this, but I think he's a president, let's say that. And the president of Argentina has, because the socialists always controlled everything, they gave the president a lot of power, so he's been unilaterally implementing almost exactly the same agenda that you just described happened in Estonia. And I want to find this out, but I got to believe that he's looked at Estonia and he's looked at transition and has opinions about how quickly can you go from an economic basket case, a socialist experiment where people are literally starving and hyperinflation and just everything is broken. And it is, people are desperate, and people are desperate enough to try these radical reforms that, that Mart Lahr is proposing. You talk about this a lot in the book, and I think it's an important conversation to have, like the relative virtue of a slow transition versus just doing it. And obviously Mart Lahr just did it. And you got to assume that, as dangerous as that was for him at the time, Estonia would not have succeeded if he hadn't done it that way.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, one thing to keep in mind here is, you know, the parameters of the debate. I think it's fair to say, okay, there's two questions here. What do you do? And we can call that at the time they called it the Washington Consensus, which was, you know, basically, you know, privatize, generally reduce taxes, try to make taxes, the tax base, as broad as possible, try to make spending as broad as possible, you know, and don't favor particular firms or industries or groups, but just, you know, provide public goods, generally open for free trade, generally get your monetary policy under control. And this sort of consensus, there's a reason why they called it a consensus, because people from the left to the right generally basically embraced that. That wasn't all that controversial at the time. I think people have sort of retroactively made it seem like it was controversial, but it really wasn't. What was an open question at the time was, how quickly do you do this? And there were reformers who said, you got to go slow, because you might need to adjust as you go, because you might get it wrong, and you might need all the pieces in place in order for it to work. I think if you're in 1991 and you want to reform, I certainly am not going to blame you if you think that that seems reasonable. That I could see a reasonable person thinking that. On the other hand, there were others, you know, Jeff Sachs and others who observed the same situation and said, look, you just got to go fast. One, it's going to be painful. Our friend Pete Becky, you know, puts it in one of his books, you know, a lot of what happens in a socialist economy is most people wake up and they go to the wrong job in the wrong industry in the wrong location. And so if that's what your training is, and you're suddenly exposed to free market forces where consumers are making choices rather than central, you know, planners, then you may end up, you know, that's going to be a potentially painful transition. There's no question about that. And so what people said is, what the people who are in favor of a quicker reform said, look, it's going to be painful, but you are going to lose whatever political capital you have if you prolong that pain. So just, you know, bite the bullet and just get it done with. And by the way, it's interesting to read, you know, accounts of Paul Volcker, for example. If you read Jennifer Rubin's new biography of Milton Friedman and what he was dealing with and trying to break the back of 14 years of inflation in the United States, it's not all that dissimilar to what, you know, we encounter when we try to reform things in the West as well. And so Jeff Sachs has this great metaphor. He says, you know, trying to do the gradual reform is like Great Britain deciding that it's going to switch the side that they drive on from the left to the right, but it's going to do it first with trucks and then later with cars. And his point is like, look, it's going to just sow chaos. So anyway, I can see how somebody in 1991 might say, you know, gee, I don't know whether fast or slow is the best approach. Now, with the hindsight of 30 years, we can see pretty clearly, and some of it comes from studies that use the Economic Freedom of the World Index, we can see that the fast movers like Estonia, they outperformed the slowpokes. Time and time again, this has been shown. So there's a good study by Robin and Kevin Greer, a husband and wife team that looks at this. There's another study by Bob and Carrie Lawson, a father-son team that have looked at the data as well. It's very, very consistent. The story that we tell in terms of Estonia of being a fast reformer that moved quickly and managed to avoid a lot of the problems of the others, you know, that's actually a pretty consistent story. So, you know, and the data, you know, demonstrate, they really tell the story. So the Estonians are now twice as wealthy as, you know, average member of the former Soviet Union. They're basically, they and the Latvians and the Lithuanians are right up there as the in the top and as fast reformers and some of the freest, some of the wealthiest people in the former Soviet Union. They have the lowest poverty rate of any former Soviet state. It's 1/10 the average of the poverty rate in the general Soviet former Soviet states. They have more startups than any other country in Europe. They have more unicorns, which are startups valued at over $1 billion, than any other country in Europe. They have corruption levels that are actually better than in the United States. They're comparable to Canada, and they're the lowest of any former Soviet state. Their infant mortality rate was, which was once, you know, several times higher than neighboring Finland, is now less than that in Finland. They've closed the gap in terms of their life expectancy with the rest of the world. So just, you know, marker after marker after marker, happiness, you know, public perceptions of the government, it's been just a remarkable success.
So go big or go home.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Yes.
So I think that this, and this is why I like this project, because there's practical lessons here for a recovering economist like me who's trying to communicate the power of these ideas and the beautiful things that happen when people are free to corroborate and collaborate and build and succeed and fail on their own accord. So I think we can wrap it up there, but I want to wrap up, because I always have to quote Hayek in my shows, but I'm thinking of this this great essay that is so so modern, even though it was written a generation ago, The Intellectuals and Socialism. And I'm sure you've read this essay, and he's you got to appreciate where Hayek's coming from, because he's literally surrounded by authoritarians closing in on him. Maybe he's hiding at the peak of Mont Pelerin at the time he's writing this essay. But The Intellectuals and Socialism, he openly asks, like, why am I not able to persuade my colleagues? Why are we losing the intellectual battle? Why? And, you know, it's not intellectuals just as university guys. He has a much broader definition of what an intellectual is. It's a public person that expresses opinions. I guess I would fit his category, and he doesn't necessarily mean it as a compliment, but he talks towards the end. You know, we market advocates, classical liberals, spent all of our time trying to repair the damage of big government at the margins, and we're constantly trying to tweak things and make things better, whereas our adversaries are out there offering this big, beautiful, utopian vision of the future. And I think what your book does, particularly about Estonia, is it taps into some of these beautiful things that I think will resonate more with people than just, let me show you the data. All due respect to Bob Lawson, it's not really a fight about data. And it's great that we have the data on our side, and it's great that the facts and the economics are on our side, but, you know, can we tell a compelling story about how we get out of the mess we're in? Like, it's happening in Argentina. It should be happening in the United States. We're accruing, I think it's $1 trillion in debt every 6 months is what I just saw. And that's insane. And that's unsustainable. But we have very few Mart Lars in our country that are like, you know, we should be radical. We should just do it. We should be big. And I'm hoping that that Milei succeeds, because then we can point to something that's not just about economic transition. It's engaging in the cultural debate and turning on young people to something more beautiful than the status quo.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think part of this is emphasizing just the full breadth of human freedom, right? You know, the freedom to buy and sell is important, because if you're not able to buy and sell, you're restricting a human desire and a human freedom that people have, a human interest that people have, and you're limiting their possibilities. But it also means that you're limiting their ability to express themselves, you know, to exchange with one another as equals, and that's, you know, deeply ingrained in our human, you know, desire to connect with people. You know, think about just, you know, the term of the idea of where the word catalaxy comes from. You know, it's a process by which strangers become friends through exchange. So I do think we kind of need to emphasize that whole, you know, width and breadth of the human condition and human freedom. And that's one of the things that's so inspiring is not only is Estonia, of course, one of the most economically free places in the world, but it's also one of the most, you know, socially free as well. The two go hand in hand.
So where can people find you, the Fraser Institute, and these monographs?
Awesome. Yeah. So the project is Realities of Socialism. If you just type in Realities of Socialism, it'll come straight to the Fraser Institute's website. You can read about, you know, Estonia. You can read about Poland. We've got several other books in the series as well. There's infographics and videos and podcasts like this one that you can share and like and distribute to all your friends.
And since we're picking on Bob Lawson, tell people about that. He's been on the show and he's talked about it, but this is an essential resource to know where your country is succeeding or failing relative to other countries.
Absolutely. So this project, go to freetheworld.com and you can see objective measures of 165 jurisdictions around the world with 45 different indicators assessing as objectively as possible what degree of freedom do governments permit people to have in order to engage in economic activity? How free are people to buy and sell and exchange and own property and run businesses? It's inspired this huge literature assessing the effect of economic freedom on human well-being. It's really an inspiring testament to the idea that you can actually answer the world's questions by looking at data, and lo and behold, you find the freedom works.
And I should just remind American viewers watching this and listening to this that America is sliding in their standing in the world, and this is unacceptable to those of us that believe in freedom and actually believe in the American idea. So that's sort of a sad way to end this, but this has been an awesome conversation, and I really appreciate your time. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you, Matt. Appreciate it.
Thanks for watching. If you liked the conversation, make sure to like the video, subscribe, and also ring the bell for notifications. And if you want to know more about Free the People, go to freethepeople.org.